Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative journalist James Ridgway, who looks ahead to a new Congress and what issues the Democrats should use their newfound power to investigate. Pokey Anderson, a Houston-based independent journalist, who examines the systemic flaws of electronic voting technology. And Tim Mooney, senior counsel with Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, who discusses his group's concern that conservative churches are violating IRS rules prohibiting partisan political activity in election campaigns. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Washington Post reports South Africa, with one of the highest HIV infection rates in the globe, has changed course on AIDS and has embraced treatment as a top priority. For 6 years, South African President Thabo Mbeki had questioned the scientific consensus that HIV causes AIDS and had been reluctant to fund treatment programs. 5.4 million South Africans are now HIV positive. Health Minister Manto Shabalala Msimang has been a lightning rod of criticism for AIDS activists for her promotion of herbal remedies like lemon, beets, and garlic to treat AIDS. In recent weeks, South African Vice President Plumzile Mlambo Nguka has set a new course by clearly stating that HIV causes AIDS and beefing up treatment programs that currently reach 200,000 people. President Mbeki has expressed growing concern about the large number of people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s who are now dying from AIDS. He appointed the vice president to run AIDS policy and has shunned his controversial health minister. After Jerry Studs, the first openly gay congressman, died in mid-October, his longtime partner Dean Hara was denied pension benefits by the U.S. government usually granted to a surviving spouse. Due to provisions of the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, the U.S. government does not recognize the 2004 Massachusetts marriage license between Studs and Hara. Studs represented Cape Cod in Congress for 24 years. He was censured in 1983 for having an affair with a page in the mid-1970s. Studs was a leading foe of the Reagan-era Contra War in Central America, an advocate of AIDS funding and protection of the environment. Studs retired in 1997. The Defense of Marriage Act also prevents gay spouses from receiving Social Security benefits, school scholarships, veterans benefits, and health benefits. Gary Busick of the group Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders observed, "There are plenty of people who have been impacted, yet this is the first time in the congressional family a distinguished member is being treated differently than other members." Neil Bush, the brother of President George W. Bush, is using his family connections and grants from federal No Child Left Behind educational funds to fund his company Ignite Learning. Formed in 1999 with funds from his parents, the first President Bush and Barbara Bush, Ignite Learning promotes a middle school educational project called Curriculum on Wheels, or CoW, used in 7 states to teach social studies, history, and science. According to the Los Angeles Times, 13 school districts have used federal funds for economically disadvantaged students to buy CoW kits, which cost $3,800 per unit. Moreover, most of the sales of CoW materials were obtained through sole source contracts with no competitive bidding. Besides these school contracts, Ignite Learning is funded by Bush family friends like the Washington Times, several oil companies such as British Petroleum and Shell, and a division of the Saudi oil company Aramco. Barbara Bush sparked controversy when the former First Lady linked a donation to Katrina victims living in Texas to the purchase of CoW kits by Texas school districts. Texas accounts for 75% of Ignite Learning's total sales. In an email exchange with the LA Times, Neil Bush denied the charge that he owed his company's success to political favoritism. Ignite has raised $23 million from outside investors. However, Bush claimed no investors had asked for access to either of his political brothers, not one White House tour, and not one Lincoln bedroom overnight. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
Since George W. Bush was appointed president by the U.S. Supreme Court after the tumultuous 2000 presidential election, America has been a virtual one-party state with the Republican Party in virtual control of the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. But even after grave questions have emerged about the administration's conduct surrounding the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the war in Iraq, and the dismal federal response to Hurricane Katrina, Congress has held few hearings and exercised little or no oversight. Branding the GOP House and Senate a rubber-stamp Congress, Democrats running to win back control of the legislature promised to bring back accountability and checks and balances that are such an essential part of the U.S. Constitution and American democracy. With Democrats in the driver's seat, many observers are asking what the party will do now with their newfound power. In an article titled Sweet Subpoena, Nine Tough Questions for Congress, published in the September-October issue of Mother Jones magazine, investigative journalist James Ridgway examines what he believes to be the top issues Democrats should investigate. These issues include looking into the causes, conduct, and effects of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, White House authorization of torture, secret prisons and warrantless surveillance, U.S. energy policy, and oil company profits. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ridgway about what we can hope for and what we can expect from the new Congress.
The Democratic Party is basically run by the conservative middle people, the Democratic Leadership Council and so on. And they are like Bush Light. They really are very careful, very, you know, itsy-bitsy movement here and there. So, I mean, if there are any Democrats that have anything going for them, they'll stand up and demand, for one thing, a really serious inquiry into the causes of this war. Rumsfeld's sitting right in the middle of it. And, you know, my view, he ought to be prosecuted for war crimes and a few other things. And they're going to want to have reopen and follow to the nth degree the issues the 9/11 Commission kind of like flipped over, you know. I mean, for example, like how come the president and the vice president weren't put under oath and testified openly? How come the FBI people weren't asked exactly what in the world they had been doing? I mean, they got off scot-free, even freer than the CIA guys. And what in God's name was the FAA doing? You know, all these people, I mean, Jane Garvey, who was head of the FAA, she was being portrayed on a website of the company she went to work for as being a heroine on 9/11. I mean, this is a woman who sat in charge of the FAA and received one warning after another of an attack and did nothing, and was told year after year after year by her own people that the security, the air security, wasn't any good and did nothing. How come she's not held accountable by anybody?
You talk about the war in Iraq and 9/11 having some investigations. What about some other issues regarding civil liberties? Do you think the Democrats will cross the line, and do you think they'll be looking into President Bush's domestic spying, as well as the torture and extraordinary rendition which this country is engaged in?
Well, I don't know, you know, about torture, because right now what's happening with the torture issue is that under the guise of being against torture, they basically haven't changed anything much, and the president can write his own torture laws. And I don't know to what extent the Democrats will go along with that. I suspect they won't raise a peep on that one. And I suspect when push comes to shove, they won't say much of anything about domestic spying either. When you mention the Patriot Act, the Democrats just get down. You know, they just can't seem to stand up on it. There are a few people that do, but, you know, the bulk of them just get down for it. They're afraid of being called unpatriotic.
On economic issues like the oil companies, the manipulation of prices, certainly we've seen a dip in prices just before the election. A lot of people find that highly suspicious. The record profits of the oil company is an additional issue. Do you think the Democrats will have the backbone to take a look or subpoena people to testify about these issues?
Well, this is something somewhere where you know, somebody like John Dingell might actually have some impact, because it's pretty simple. All you got to do is subpoena the records and subpoena the individuals involved in this Cheney task force and see to what extent these guys were divvying up the spoils in Iraq before the war was even, you know, underway, before it was even decided to go to war, which is everybody's suspicion, you know. That's the big deal here. I mean, the whole idea in Iraq was to somehow get a clamp on that oil, and the Constitution and situation in Iraq has sort of like tended towards splitting the country up in terms of economics, anyway, which then allows the different areas, the Sunni and the Shia and the Kurdish areas, to cut their own deals with the oil companies, which is to the advantage of the oil companies. So oil is the name of the game, if you ask me. But again, you got to remember the Democrats have never been very strong on this stuff.
Well, what's it going to take, James Ridgway, do you think, to push the Democrats into taking a hard line in investigating the Bush administration and the many allegations of crooked deal-making and underhanded and illegal activity? Do you think public pressure could play a role in giving the Democrats a backbone on some of these issues?
Well, yeah, I think so because, I mean, well, after all, that's how we operate here. I mean, win, lose, or draw, we've got to work through the system. There's a presidential election coming up, and there's an opportunity for dissidents in the Democratic Party, left and right, to make themselves heard in that process. And well, that doesn't always work very well. This is just the beginning, you know. I mean, if the Democrats win the House or even the Congress, I mean, that's just the beginning of a really, really serious, detailed debate leading up to the presidential election.
Well, beyond investigations and looking at wrongdoing within the Bush administration, what do you think the Democrats, or let's say progressive Democrats, have to do to make their mark in the next couple of years before the 2008 election to really give the American people a choice when they go to the ballot box the next time around, you know, in terms of the basic issues, not just the war in Iraq, but health care, education, energy policy and the like? Do you think Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats have an agenda that will meet with approval of citizens over the next couple of years?
Well, I don't know. If the past is any guide, the Democrats will go down the middle, down the right middle, and they won't do much of anything. But when the conservatives were conducting their revolution and getting set to take the Congress, the issue was, can you run the government? It's like, can you govern? That's really the issue for the Democrats. Now, I know they're not in power in the sense of running the presidency, and the Congress is all very divisive and everything. But still, the issue here is, can you run the government? And what are you going to do to make sure that happens? And these investigations aren't just, you know, for the hell of having some investigation and people grandstanding in front of television cameras. It's to get the facts that enable you to run the government. I mean, if in fact these energy companies sat around in a private meeting with officials of the United States government to cut a deal on Iraqi oil, that tells us a lot about what's going on here, and it gives us some clue as to how to operate against these companies, or with these companies, or whatever, however you want to put it. So I think the basic thing here is whether the Democrats can actually run the country.
That was investigative journalist James Ridgway. Read his article titled, Sweet Subpoena, 9 Tough Questions for Congress, in the pages of the September-October issue of Mother Jones Magazine or online at www.motherjones.org. This election season marks the first time many states have used electronic voting machines. Their use was encouraged by the 2002 Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, and was intended to reduce the problems caused by hanging chads and other flaws in older voting systems. But many individuals and organizations who have investigated how the various new machines work, using a variety of electronic technology, have criticized them as vulnerable to malfunction and intentional hacking. In the last several elections, some major flaws have been uncovered, such as thousands of ballots going to the wrong candidates, counting phantom votes, or the loss of large numbers of ballots. But while the big errors are easier to uncover and correct, it's the smaller shifts in vote counts that may never be detected. The New York Times reports that in the 2006 congressional election, half of the 45 most competitive races were conducted on electronic machines with no independent verification, such as a paper printout. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Pokey Anderson, a Houston-based independent journalist who has spent the past 3.5 years researching the promises and pitfalls of electronic voting machines. She describes the changes wrought since the Help America Vote Act and proposes a method to help protect the integrity of America's elections.
Embedded in HAVA was an enticement of $3.9 billion to local and state governments to buy new equipment. And the drumbeat became, you know, get rid of the chads and get electronic voting equipment. It just kind of jumped out of the cake, you know, untested, and everybody was, like, applauding. But we're all guinea pigs for this electronic voting. especially the paperless stuff where you can't really recount it. It turns out that the architecture of voting is so unique that using an electronic system without any kind of backup or another way to independently recount is fundamentally flawed. It doesn't, I mean, you can argue all day long about open source code and having certification and all these different things, but it's fundamentally flawed. It's like a physical impossibility to secure this stuff, to determine what software is actually running on something, to investigate hundreds of thousands of lines of computer code and see if you can find some sort of little hidden Trojan horse. And then when you overlay on top of that the reward involved for stealing an election, the House of Representatives Appropriations Committee hands out $1 trillion of our tax money a year. So that's a huge reward of who's going to win an election. You know, and computer code is really handy because you can change it really quickly without leaving a trace. So it's a test tube, almost like it's designed for the perfect crime. You have, if one person can get in there, according to the study by Ed Felton at Princeton, one person with 1 minute's access could hypothetically steal a whole state's vote. And because electrons don't really leave fingerprints very well, it's not like robbing a bank where you might have to actually, you know, show up with a gun and stuff. If you can do it remotely or in the, you know, 3 months before this stuff actually went out to on election day, it might be the perfect crime. And you might not even have to have an investigation because maybe nobody knows it was stolen. The theory is if you were going to steal elections, you wouldn't probably steal it with a 50% flip of the votes, but you might steal 3% or 5%, and that might be all you need.
Pokey Anderson, can you run down the main new types of voting machines?
The newest kind of voting is called, variously, it's called touchscreen, it's called DRE, or it's called electronic voting. And basically, those are all the same thing. And in those cases, you know, you push a button or you turn a dial, and your vote is registered electronically. And then, you know, later it is sent some way or another to a central count. The other very popular system of voting is called optical scan. And that is kind of like an SAT. It's a piece of paper. You fill in a bubble or an oval with a pencil, and then later that goes through a scanning machine that counts your vote. Now, some people say, well, that's much better because you have paper. And yes, it's always better if you have a paper record of the vote. But once it goes into that scanner, it becomes digitized, and your vote is now electrons. And that kind of tabulating of the vote can be stolen. Weavers are going out of style. They're heavy, and they have a whole bunch of moving parts, and it gets hard to replace them and repair them. But there are many stories of how the actual mechanisms can be shaved so that not all the votes count. The other method, tried and true, is paper ballots, counted by human beings. And that's still done in a number of states. The thing about paper is you can steal one vote, or maybe you can steal a whole ballot box, but a determined thief can't steal a whole state by touching a few keystrokes.
So what do you recommend, that everyone go back to paper ballots?
Yes, I and a number of people who've looked at this for a long time have come to the conclusion that counting votes electronically cannot be secured. So what you need is physical observation by anybody. But an eighth grader should be able to tell in their precinct that this thing is working by just watching. You shouldn't have barcodes or cryptography or, you know, advanced degree professors of computers that you have to rely on. It should be that any citizen can determine that their vote was cast and counted.
That was Pokey Anderson, a Houston-based independent journalist. For more information on the issues surrounding electronic voting, visit the website of Black Box Voting at www.blackboxvoting.org.
The role of religion in American politics has been on the rise as the Republican Party has become increasingly identified with and beholden to Christian fundamentalist groups. The political agenda of conservative religious organizations that oppose abortion, gay marriage, and stem cell research has been fully adopted by the GOP. In turn, religious activists have been extremely successful at turning out their conservative base at election time to back Republican candidates. Almost a quarter of U.S. voters who cast ballots in the 2004 presidential election identified themselves as born-again or evangelical Christians, with a vast majority of them supporting President Bush. During the 2004 campaign, documents surfaced which indicated that the Bush-Cheney re-election operation had urged Christian supporters to turn over church directories seeking to identify friendly congregations. This activity fueled accusations that the Bush campaign supported churches that violated laws barring tax-exempt charities from engaging in any type of partisan political campaigning. In the midst of the hotly contested 2006 congressional campaign, the nonpartisan group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, filed a complaint asking the Internal Revenue Service to investigate the role that two churches may have played in the re-election campaign of the Kansas Attorney General, a Republican. Other allegations of IRS rules violations have been leveled at religious groups in California, Minnesota, Missouri, and Ohio. Spokespersons for CREW have asked why the IRS has confined their investigations to liberal organizations such as the NAACP and a liberal church in California. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tim Mooney, senior counsel for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. He discusses his group's concern that the IRS is unfairly targeting progressive groups while ignoring politically conservative church violators.
This dates back to September, or early September. And a couple of Kansas-based news organizations published an internal campaign memorandum that was authored by Attorney General Klein, and it detailed some of the efforts that he was going to be using amongst his campaign staff to recruit churches to aid in his reelection efforts. And inside that memorandum, it included a bunch of activities that really constituted illegal support of the campaign by those churches that he was going after. And in that memorandum, he identified several of the churches that were included in our complaint.
What are the churches alleged to have done in terms of campaigning?
Well, it's really kind of a broad-based activity that's been put forth by the Klein campaign. He identified in the memorandum a few churches, Light of the World and Wanamaker Woods Nazarene, both in Topeka, for instance, and they were being used and had agreed, according to the memo, to help disseminate his campaign literature. Now, IRS rules absolutely prohibit redistribution of partisan campaign literature because it shows support or opposition for candidates, and that's a violation of tax law. In addition to that, there are also some issues with the use of the different churches around Kansas for basically distributing campaign videos. And although there were no churches that were specifically mentioned in there, what was problematic was that the Klein campaign was actually giving bad advice to these churches, suggesting that all they had to do was kind of have some kind of internal policy that said if anybody came with a campaign video, regardless of party, that would be enough. The reality is that the IRS rules say rather specifically, and they're well established, that churches have to offer equal opportunity to the opposing candidates as well. So it's kind of a sad state of events when the chief law enforcement officer of a state is giving bad advice on the law.
What can you tell us about the Internal Revenue Service investigations into these activities on the part of churches and other nonprofits, and the concern that the IRS has unfairly targeted progressive nonprofits like the NAACP, a church in California in Pasadena, I believe, while ignoring political activities undertaken by conservative churches working on behalf of Republican Party candidates?
Well, that was something that we actually mentioned to the IRS commissioner in our complaints. It's important that he remain above the political fray on all this. The Internal Revenue Service is not meant to and should not be, and by law is not allowed to be, a partisan type of entity. And yet we have seen some evidence that it's being used for partisan purposes. You mentioned the Pasadena Church, the All Saints Church, the NAACP as well. And we are very concerned that the commissioner is perhaps tilting the Internal Revenue Service to be a partisan type of entity, which it was used back in the early 1970s by Richard Nixon, and we're hoping that it's not going back to those days. The Internal Revenue Service for years has been lauded as a nonpartisan entity within government, perhaps the most insulated of all of the executive branch agencies, basically, even though it's a part of the Treasury Department. So we're hoping that it's not going in that direction, but the evidence seems to be pointing to the contrary. We're hoping that this election, that we're going to take Commissioner Everson at his word, that he's going to look at all of the evidence, and hopefully he and his folks who are in the Enforcement Division will take a look at the complaints that we're filing, and will look at it without a partisan streak at all.
Is there any way that your organization or other groups can force the IRS to open up their books so that we can see, the public can see for themselves, whether there's a political bias in these kinds of investigations?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. We've actually asked the Internal Revenue Service through a Freedom of Information Act request to let folks know a little bit more about what it goes into their decision-making processes in these areas to make sure that there isn't a political bias that is going on here. And that request is outstanding, and I'm afraid that we haven't received anything from the service at this point.
Well, finally, Tim Mooney, what would you advise citizens to do who are concerned that the law is being violated by church or other nonprofit charity organizations in terms of their involvement in political campaigns?
Well, it's important to understand what the rules are. First and foremost, a 501c3, whether, like I said, whether it's secular or whether it is a church, is prohibited from doing things that support or oppose candidates. And a lot of folks get that confused with taking a stance on issues or even ballot measures. Those are absolutely perfectly legal for these entities to be involved in. What's not okay is using the resources of those entities to support or oppose candidates. So if anybody sees something like that going on in their community, well, they have a couple of different options. They could make a complaint to the IRS themselves, and they've got that ability as citizens, or they can give us a little bit of a heads up on that, because we've been getting some tips on these issues as well, and they can go to the CREW website to help us out on that.
That was Tim Mooney, Senior Counsel for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Contact CREW by calling area code 202-408-5565 or visit their website at www.citizensforethics.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.